Hi, everybody. Welcome into this special edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show. My name is Ryan Ballingy. Good to have you here with us. You can get a hold of me on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy. Get a hold of Golf News Net on your favorite social media service at the handle Golf News Net, even though we really only use Twitter, sometimes Facebook. And you can download our apps for Amazon Fire TV and Roku TV. We are presented by our friends at 2Under. They're the purveyors of hashtag asset management. If you play a lot of golf, if you've played a lot of golf over the years like me, particularly in hot, sweaty, humid conditions like I've been playing the last couple of weeks, then you know the value of having great underwear when you play golf. The kind of underwear that doesn't stick to your body, it doesn't cause you to feel uncomfortable, it keeps you free and flowing, the air moving, and you dry. And that's what 2Under does with their golf-specific underwear that you can wear with their famous Joey pouch to keep your boys separated from the rest of your body, keeping them nice and dry, and giving you the comfort you need to play your best golf. The material is extremely comfortable. It's very breathable. It feels really good to wear it. And not only do they have underwear that's specific for golf, but you can also have it for just daily use, for when you're at the gym, and even at nighttime if you want to sleep in special underwear while you go night-night. So head over to 2under.com, number 2UNDR.com. Use the promo code GNN20. You're going to save 20% on anything you purchase, including their great loungewear, their socks, they've got bags, all kinds of stuff that's high quality and in demand. So head over to 2under.com today. So we have a two-part kind of episode here, and it's all about the Myrtle Beach World Am. So the first part of the episode this week is going to be me kind of talking about my experience playing in the World Am, which has been a tremendous sponsor for us throughout the entire year. And then we're going to bring in Mitch Lawrence, who lives in Conway, South Carolina, which is not too far away, basically adjoining to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, talk about his experience playing in the World Am, and a follow-up conversation to what we had a couple of episodes ago, maybe last episode, talking about making the switch, even if temporarily, from playing hickory equipment, which he's played for a dozen years or so, to modern sticks from both Ben Hogan Golf, which we talked about in preparation for their arrival, and also Newth Golf's high heat line of equipment. Before we get into anything, I want to give it a shout out to a bunch of different people about the World Am. First, to John and Cheryl Dunigan, who joined me on several different dinners, and we got together each night at the 19th hole for some drinks and just conversation about the day. It was great to meet you. We had so much fun at dinner. I found out more about the culinary delights of Myrtle Beach in the nights that we went out from Sunday to Thursday night, as opposed to the prior week when I had been in Myrtle Beach or other weeks where I've been in Myrtle Beach. Finally got some places that I can recommend as kind of higher end restaurants now. Black Tie, Hook and Barrel are awesome. And I'm so glad that we got to experience those together. And it was great to see you and meet you in person. And then I want to give a shout out to Scott Tomasello, Jeff Monday, Bill Golden, the gang at what was formerly known as Myrtle Beach Golf Holiday, what's now known as Golf Tourism Solutions. Same with Chris King at Kingfish Communications. They put on a really good tournament. They work really hard to make 3,200 golfers extremely happy on 55 different golf courses in Myrtle Beach. They've got a variety of demands to manage, from customers to courses to vendors to everybody is down their throat to make sure this thing goes perfectly as possible, and they did a really good job. I mean, it's a marvel to be able to run a tournament like that and then have a venue each night to manage each well on top of that. A lot of kudos to them for what they've accomplished and for getting this tournament to the place that it was this year. Again, really well run. I know a number of the golf courses in the Grand Strand area in Myrtle Beach had a really difficult winter or early spring, one or the other. And a lot of winter kill, a lot of places had to replant greens, shut down their facilities for 4, 5, 6, 7 weeks at a time to basically scrape off the putting surfaces and regrow them as best they could in time for the prime season. And a lot of places did a good job, or as best as humanly possible, with the facilities they had, the resources they had. So to be able to incorporate all of those courses into the rotation, make it fair for everybody, to have a really, really good experience, play a really high-end course, play three very good golf courses as well. Kudos to them for doing it. I know they have a team, and I know that it's not huge, but it's pretty incredible what they accomplished. And I also want to thank them for their support of this idea that we put together of promoting the World Am on this podcast and talking to you about the experiences. In 2015, I think it was, I came down to Myrtle Beach with my wife and my son. Our daughter had not been born yet. We were going to go through Myrtle Beach to Atlanta for a handful of three, four days or something like that for a vacation. And I know that sounds weird in August too, but it was very nice. And we came into the 19th, Myrtle Beach. I went to the 19th hole one night, spent some time with friends like Brian Katrick, like John McGinnis. Had a really such a great time with John Daly too that night, and really sold me on the notion of the 19th hole and playing in the tournament someday. Unfortunately, that was able to come about because of their support and their interest. And basically, it was kind of the result of being able to go down there and experience the tournament and basically do it for net-free, you know, in the end. I also want to give a shout-out to the folks at the Marina Inn at Grand Dunes. I have to tell you kind of this is kind of getting into the basis of the trip stories. But I arrived in Myrtle Beach the week before. Like I said, I went into a house with 27, I think ultimately it was 27 or 26 people, and Cherry Grove, which is in North Myrtle Beach. And we had a fabulous time in this 7-bedroom house, 5 families, all kinds of people coming together from multiple generations. And we had accommodations on a house on the beach with a nice little pool, beach access. I mean, it was a dream. It was really wonderful to do. And then when all of that ended on Saturday and everyone left, I was the only one left in town with my sister-in-law who lives there full-time. So we hung out Saturday. Sunday came, had to go pick up my rental car and check in at my hotel after playing golf with John and Cheryl at a pre-tournament event at Wild Wing Plantation, which was a very nice track, very fun to play. And I get to the hotel. It's called Camelot by the Sea. And I booked it on Priceline, and it just wasn't what I was hoping for. It's kind of your classic beach unit. I should have known better. The bedroom unit was on the hallway end instead of the beach end. So you weren't getting up every morning looking at the beach. There was a living room for that. You were sleeping with all the riffraff right next to an elevator, all that stuff. I was like, if I'm playing tournament golf and there's a very distinct possibility I could be drinking a lot each night, which actually didn't turn out to be the case, I'm not going to not get sleep and go play golf. And to their credit, and Priceline's credit, by the way, shout out to them for this, they refunded my money. I said, we understand. Tastes are very specific sometimes, and here's your money back. And I went over to the Marina Inn at Grand Dunes, which had an incredible deal on Priceline. I'd heard so much about the Marina Inn. I'd never played Grand Dunes. I knew we would play it through this, and snatched up the opportunity to go there. It's a 4-diamond resort. Checked in that evening. The room was incredible. The service was great. The staff was awesome. Shout out to Jane, the bartender, who was just the best. And had a wonderful time there. And each morning got up looking out the window, knowing that I was playing Grand Dunes, which is across the Intercoastal Waterway, each day, you know, on the final day, each day knowing I'm going to get there eventually. They were awesome. I cannot recommend them more. If you're going to be in Myrtle Beach and you don't care for the kind of traditional beach-style resort, go to the Marina Inn. You're going to have a fabulous, fabulous time. And so I got there on Sunday evening, went to dinner with Cheryl and John, and then started the lineup. And I've not played tournament golf, and I mean tournament golf. I don't mean like the old Greensburg Cup, which I'm looking at the trophy for, and I love having in my office. But the reality is, it's a drinking tournament, and I haven't played in like a non-club championship or non-Argyle Country Club type thing in like 6 years. I just don't play a lot of tournament golf. I, for whatever reason, kind of gotten away from it after high school. And I knew this would be 72 holes, and I knew I would be nervous, and I didn't know the format worked. I didn't know anybody, and all of those things kind of factor in. And I get to the International Club, and the greens are running a little slow. They had a bad winter. They replanted the greens. They had reopened like 6 weeks ago, so you knew you kind of have to bang everything at the hole. It was going to play about 7,000 yards. It had rained. It was a little soft. so it wasn't going to roll very much. And the tournaments run each day, the shotgun start. We start at 9 a.m. You go out to your hole, and you start. And we drew, our group, our foursome, drew, and they put two flights on each course, by the way, for the most part. So you're organized by your skill level, gender and age, one of those three things, if not all three. And we got to the first hole that we were going to play, and it's a 190-yard par 3 all over water, and I about wet myself. Like I said, I haven't played tournament golf in forever. It's different. When everything counts, it's just different. The stuff I wouldn't notice, like the guy across the street, OB, who was mowing his lawn and trimming his hedges, and the water, I wouldn't have noticed as much. The OB, I would not have noticed at all. And I got up there kind of nervously. Had not hit any balls on the range. I just don't tend to do that. I don't like it. Putted some. And I just pulled the crap out of it to the left. So it wouldn't go in the water, but then I had no chance of hitting the green. I was really happy to make bogey, but for the first 3 holes, I felt extremely nervous. And I don't feel that when I play golf. Golf is supposed to be fun. Maybe that's why I don't play tournament golf that much anymore. And it just is a different feeling. Second hole, I made a double with a mud ball, and I'm 3 over through 2 thinking, I'm going to finish DFL, I'm going to embarrass myself, what the hell are you doing? You're on a golf course that's super tight, there's OB or water hazards everywhere, because that's just the nature of Myrtle Beach golf in a lot of cases, fit into neighborhoods or there's housing around it, and it's a swamp. I mean, ultimately it's a swamp, there's going to be water, there's going to be OB, you have to deal with it. And got on the third hole, hit just the weakest 2-iron imaginable, and one of the short par 4, shortish par 4, 410 yards or something, and left myself 6-iron in from 190. So I'm playing these new irons that I can't tell you about for 6 days from a brand I can't mention yet, but they're club longer, basically, than the irons I've been playing all season, and either the MP18 MMCs or the C300 Forge from Wilson, and because that's the way they're designed to be. They're designed to be a distance iron. And, well, they're a little bit longer than C300. And I hit the 6-iron from the left side of the fairway. I'm first to go because I'm shortest. Everyone else hit driver. And I just smooth it right in there, right on line, 17, 18, 20 feet away, something like that. And I finally hear good shot. I'm like, I can do this. I can play okay. And the rest of the way really wasn't that bad. I made mistakes, I scored poorly on holes, but I shot 84, and part of that was I made a horrible wreck of the finish. I had, I think, a bogey, and then before that, I had a triple at the last. I mean, I just kind of let myself down with dumb mistakes down the stretch, and they were wholly preventable, and that really got under my skin, because I went from potentially shooting like 78, 77, which is probably what I should have shot, given the way that I played, to 84. And I just beat myself up over it. But I really enjoy the people that I play with. I play with a guy, Alex from New Zealand, who's the funniest dude I've ever played with. Probably hit about 240 off the tee, playing on a golf course way too long for him, and just was relentlessly fun. He made a lot of long putts, made probably 4 birdies. And you're playing in a skins game, but I didn't play the skins game. I don't carry a lot of cash. But guys were playing in a skins game too, so if you were having a bad round, you could still try for birdies and eagles, and you could get paid, you know, a good couple $100 for a skin. So guys were going for that. The guys I was playing with were equally nervous. I mean, there's no doubt about that. One hole, a guy named Nick, who used to be a long driver, and then injuries kind of ruined that. He hit 2 provisionals from the middle of the fairway on a par 5 because he thought he had knocked the prior 2 OB. And he was thinking he was going from hitting 2 to hitting 4, then 6, then 8. He was looking at 10 or worse. And instead, he made 5. Made par. He found the first ball. It was incredible. And a lot of the guys that I play with, when you get to talking to them, they play tournament golf on the reg. Like, at their home, wherever they play in their PGA section or their State Golf Association or whoever presents the tournaments for amateurs, that's what they do. Some of them don't belong to clubs because they play so much tournament golf. And I'm sitting here thinking the last time I had to count all of these was a long time ago. And that put me a little bit of a disadvantage. So the second day, we go to this place, Arrowhead Country Club. It's on a really small plot of land, and somehow Ray Floyd fit 27 holes on it. Probably should have just done 18. But the golf course was in phenomenal shape. The greens were the fastest of the week. Probably ran close to 12 on the snip meter. I mean, they were country club fast. And it was a public facility. I mean, you could play. But very tight. Really tight. Not as tight as international, but it felt claustrophobic at first. And I realized on the second tee, stop playing stupid and conservative and just play you. Play your style. And committed to basically driver the rest of the week from there on. And the shot that really was the clincher, and this was, by the way, the best driving week of my life outside the four rounds I played at Sand Valley where there's fairway everywhere. This is probably the best driving week of my life. And shout out to Cobra Golf for the King 8 F8 Plus and to TPT Golf for their driver shaft because it's been incredible this year. That said, we get to this hole. It's a 370-yard, I'll say, 380-yard par 4. Artificial lake basically covers a huge portion of the dog leg that goes about 90 degrees at the corner. You can either just hit a 3-iron basically straight out about 230 or about 260 to the corner, and you hit a wedge in, or you just try to fly it between basically two upright-type trees, upright posts, and get over the lake, carry it 265, and get in the fairway. And I was like, yeah, well, I'll hit the iron. And I was like, no, I'm gonna do me. If I did this at home, I would hit driver as far and as hard as I could, and hopefully it got across the water. And sure enough, I split the uprights, landed exactly where it needed to, and I had 40 yards left. Now, I didn't make the birdie, but I felt confident off the tee, and that changed my entire feeling about driving over the course of the week. I stopped thinking about OB. I mean, here and there I would, but by and large, I didn't have to think about it off the tee. I was just puring it. So I had that locked in. But what happened about this, I guess the seventh hole, it started to rain. And we were like, well, it's probably going to rain 15 minutes. Let's keep playing. And within like 30 seconds, the sky had opened up. And in tournament golf, when you're told to stop, you stop. And otherwise, you keep playing. And we kept playing because no one told us to stop. There's no weather delay. But a group behind us had stopped, at least one. And there was no one in front of us playing. So other groups had stopped. Well, I made a mess of a bogey on consecutive holes, and then on the par 5 to close the 9, at about like 215 in, after a really solid drive, and I just, it should have been a birdie. If we had stopped, it probably could have been a birdie, but it was a par, and I figured I'd lost 3 strokes, and we get through the 9, and we're at the green, and we see 3 groups on 10th tee. So we know there are at least 3 groups, probably 4 playing the hole, and they've all agreed to stop. And that kind of bothered me, because no one told them to stop, so you should have kept going. But they did, and so we had to stop. And we stopped for about 45 minutes before the groups got going again, and then by then I was kind of checked out. It was bad. I still drove the ball pretty well until about the 14th or 15th hole, but by then the rain had caught up to the golf course. There was nothing the staff could do. I mean, there was a lot of casual water, and I was like, nope, I'm done with this. And my club was starting to slip out of my hands. Did that with 3 consecutive shots on a par 5, and every one of those balls went into a water. I made 11, and I turned in 90. And was like, I just got to block this out of my memory. I can't do it. But I been so downtrodden thinking, well, this is going to be the worst score of the day. Now I'm definitely DFL. But I still wasn't. I was still beating like 5 or 6 people. And on the next day, so this is the kind of the forgetful round. I always forget something in the course of like a trip. I forgot 2 things, gloves and shoes. So I didn't worry about gloves. I was like, I'll go without a glove. It'll be okay. It wasn't. And I went to the pro shop and bought a pair of Adidas shoes. They actually turned out to be really nice. I'm still wearing them. And we played this place called Meadowlands Country Club, which is just, or Golf Club, which is just over the border into North Carolina. And it's kind of your traditional southern semi-muni course, which is in pretty good shape. Actually, some of the best greens of the week were on that course. Pins were in weird places, like on sides of hills, like trying to protect the golf course a little bit. And there were a lot of similar holes. I mean, again, nature of kind of the reality of golf courses, a lot of holes feel the same after 54 holes. You're going to hit a drive over something or around something or to avoid something. And so my unrelenting commitment to driver led to probably four or five drop shots in the first nine holes. I was nine over through nine. And still driving the ball great. It was just going through the fairway into bad lies. And part of that was not knowing the golf course, and part of that was not caring. And part of that was getting bad lies even when I hit good drives because they went too far. And so we got to a par five, and I just smashed a drive. Had a six iron in and slipped in my hand. And the ball fanned into a hazard, and I made seven. So I made back-to-back sevens. I shanked one in the woods on the prior hole. And that went like a hazard. Oh, it was just bad. I shanked one basically every day. Except the last day. And I'm like, okay, this is bad. You're like 14 over through 11 holes. You certainly are not going to finish in the top 10 at this point. What are you going to do? And I play the final seven holes in one over par. The golf was just as good as the first nine holes. I mean, 10 and 11 were bad. But the difference was I finished off holes. I kind of was hyper-aggressive. Like, all right, you got to take all the problems out and do that. And started making putts. Things started going okay. And really only bogeyed the last hole, which is like a 480-yard hole into the wind with two hazards to hit over. So I can live with that. And shot 84. I'm sorry, 87. Jeez. So I was 15 over for the round. But I felt like I played really good golf. I had some momentum. And the final day, Grand Dunes, was everything I expected to be. It was, I mean, it had sand on the greens. I'm not sure why they did that, but the greens still rolled really well. And I finally felt totally engaged, because after three rounds of playing very similar style architecture, Grand Dunes weren't really two holes that were totally the same. I wasn't hitting the same shot, same look, same feel over and over again. I mean, I hit a lot of 9 and 8 irons into greens, but I felt like I had to pick spots. I had to care where the ball went. And the greens were compelling too. And I probably should have made more putts. But again, I shot 81. I let that one get away from me. I bled out after shooting 36 on the front nine. And it was like, come on, man. I could have been under par. I mean, honestly, I played that well. But bled out. But I had a really fun time playing with the guys that I did. The 12 guys that I played with, they were from all over. Like I said, New Zealand, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Florida, Georgia, Cincinnati, Ohio, all over the place. Florida? All over the place. Puerto Rico, actually. Brooklyn. A lot of cool guys. And the group, the flight was interesting because we're the only ones that were playing gross golf. There's no net for us. There's no strokes. So you could really compare with somebody. You could talk to them about golf and feel like you weren't talking to someone that might not be able to relate to your game. It was really cool. And we got along well during the day. And some of those guys know each other pretty well, so they went out at night and stuff like that. I didn't. I went to the 19th hole each night and hung out with Mitch Lawrence, who will be on the show in a little bit, and his wife Ava, who does pool demonstrations, billiards demonstrations, plays games of nine ball for charity. So you pay $10 to play basically one of the greatest billiards players of all time. And if whether she kicks your ass or not, that goes to charity, but you get to play against her. And it's really fun to watch her just demolish people. And sometimes people do win a game of nine ball, and then she just throttled the next person. And it's a really cool little area for the 19th hole. They go to the Myrtle Beach Convention Center. You go in, they have vendors of different kinds. So Snell Golf was there, Peak Vision was there, a number of kind of local vendors and resorts. I desperately want a soft tub. They were there. Really would like a hot tub. Got to work on that. And then they had nightly live versions of Katrick and McGinnis on Tap from SiriusXM, and some of the folks from Golf Channel's Morning Driver there, Charlie Reimer, Chantel McCabe, Damon Hack were there, and they were all kind of running little things in the convention center hall where they were in the band and the other one. They had free well drinks, free beer. I mean, it was a place to be. It was a good spot. And I just enjoyed catching up with Mitch each day and talking to John and Cheryl and Mitch's friend Bob, who's now one of my favorite people. It only took about 30 minutes for that to happen. And it just was a blast. So my takeaways, I guess, are there's no other place, and you'll hear this later because I pre-taped with Mitch, but there's no other place that could pull this off. Myrtle Beach is wholly unique in that there are 70 golf courses in the area, about 70, that all come together at this time of year, this week before kids start school, or in some places after kids start school, especially a lot of southern states, and can bring together 3,200 people of all skill levels and play golf and be able to accommodate them and give them a good experience. You know, for, what, $500-some-odd, if you registered through us or you did early bird, you could play four really good golf courses. You got some merch, a little swag bag. You got free drinks each night at the 19th hole, some free finger food from local restaurants. So it was very good. You got free entertainment. I mean, what more do you want? That's a tremendous, tremendous deal. And they had daily prizes and all, I mean, closest to the pin, closest to the center line, longest drive. You had the side games, of course, if you wanted to play them. It was limitless. And it was really easy to get around the area. It's not like there's a lot of morning traffic. I mean, there's traffic, but if you go down south toward Merle's Inlet, but if you're up north, not really. If you head out, a little bit from the shore. I guess there's a little bit of traffic maybe in Conway, but not that much either. And so you could get to places in 30 minutes or less from where I was, and can make it really easy. You just roll in whenever you want. The facilities were there. If you wanted to practice, great. If you didn't, all right. They had carts and beverages all over the place. I mean, you paid cash at the courses, but if you wanted to be a drinking player, you could be. If you wanted to treat it very seriously, you could do that too. And no one was there to really get in your way about that. They didn't really have any rules disputes. So, I mean, I think things were on the up and up on our end. I'm sure there are sandbaggers in every group. I'm pretty certain of that. That's just how handicaps work. I don't care where it is. And fortunately, I didn't have to deal with that in the gross division. But had a blast. And I love going to Myrtle Beach. I've talked about this a lot of times. I love going to Myrtle Beach because I can just play golf when I want. I could play on a place like I did on family vacation, like Azalea Sands, which was a place I could drink a 12-pack, hit some okay putts and some not-that-great greens, and just have a good time with the company, with friends and family. Or I could play a place like Grand Dunes, which was architecturally interesting, fun, engaging, and in really good shape. And I could play everywhere in between. I could play even a little less than Azalea Sands. I could play a place that's like an executive course for $12. So you could do pretty much any kind of style of golf down there. And having been able to kind of get a better feel of the culinary scene down there, that was really fun to know that there are good restaurants I can go to that aren't just your typical seaside resort restaurant, you know, a steakhouse, which we went to one. It was very good. Chuck's was awesome. Or like a seafood buffet where you're probably not going to get the best seafood, and it's not going to be local, and it probably won't be as fresh. So we got like Hook and Barrel, which was steamed right in front of you and caught that day. I mean, that fresh. So that was cool to know. I got to know the city a little bit better. I felt like I could get around town pretty good after 2 weeks of being there. And Myrtle Beach is changing. It's going from what was basically a honky-tonk country town with a beach attached and some hokey hotels to a pretty diverse place with a burgeoning permanent population. About 1,500 people there move every month, and houses are going up like mad. There's a Topgolf that's going up in the area near Broadway by the beach, which is kind of like their downtown, sort of. And it's a changing city, and it's really cool to see each time I go down there, it changes just a little bit more, but not totally loses identity as what it always had been. And so there's something for everybody down there. And I know Myrtle Beach is not everyone's cup of tea. I used to go to Ocean City, Maryland for many years. And I know that's not everyone's cup of tea. Every beach destination kind of has its quirks and the certain type of people that like it the most, people that will tolerate it, people that hate it. But if you love golf, you kind of have to go to Myrtle Beach at some point in your life, because it just is kind of mind-boggling how much golf there is to play. I mean, I've played probably 15 or 20 courses in Myrtle Beach over the years, and I'm still about 50 shy of getting through them all. So I've got a lot of work left to do. I hope I can go do this again. My son started kindergarten last week, and I missed the first day of that because it kind of didn't work out with registration, and we sent him to a Catholic school, and we didn't know that was going to start sooner than public school, all that stuff. But I hope I can do it again. I would like to do it again, and I think it would be really fun to kind of evolve in the competition. I'm still planning on being in the gross division for the foreseeable future. Hopefully I'll run into some of these guys again. They were a lot of fun. It was weird being the middle-aged guy. A lot of these guys were younger than me, hitting it as far or farther than me. Some shorter, but some farther. And I had a lot of fun competing with them because they made it fun. They weren't super serious. They were serious, but not super serious. And they made it really welcoming and enjoyable. So hopefully you'll take a look at the Myrtle Beach World Am. Even if it's something you do maybe every couple of years. You don't have to do it every year. I mean, some people do it every year. But every couple of years even. It's a good August vacation. Something before Labor Day. Kind of round out maybe your golf season. Or extend it depending on where you live, I guess. And just have fun with it. You can make of it what you want. It can be a rowdy kind of group trip. Where you guys just kind of let loose on the town. It could be a couples trip where you play with your wife like John and Cheryl did. They went to different venues each day, got together in the evening, and had a lovely time together. You do it as a couples trip with a lot of couples who all want to play golf and go to different places. Rent a house and do something like that. I would not recommend necessarily doing it solo. While I had a lot of fun because I have a good number of friends in this, I would make sure you come down with somebody you know, because even if you don't play in the same flight together, it's just good to have someone to talk to and kind of, even if you don't go to the 19th hole every night, you have someone to dine with, stuff like that. It's good to do it with a friend. But again, I want to say thanks to the folks at all involved with the World Am and with Golf Holiday / Golf Tourism Solutions. They made it a really special week for me, and it got me back engaged in tournament golf. So hopefully I can play a couple of events in the fall, start kind of getting into these tournament situations again where scores count, and try to prove my mettle, because I still think I got a lot left in the tank as a competitive golfer, and I can do some really cool things if I put my mind to it and commit to being a better golfer than I have been maybe in the last couple of years. All right, we'll go take a break, and we'll come back with Mitch Lawrence. But first, I want to tell you about my friends at TGA Premier Sports. Do you have a passion for sports? You probably do if you listen to this podcast. You probably like things other than golf, tennis, baseball, basketball, probably watch those sports. You probably have kids or no kids or have family members who play in a variety of sports. Do you like working with them? Do you like enjoying seeing them grow and having a good time and learn in the process? Well, you can combine those passions. You can combine the things that make you happy and make them your job by working with TGA Premier Sports to become a franchise owner. TJ Premier Sports is a franchise-based business headed by my friend Josh Jacobs, who has been on the show multiple times. And he's designed a business that eliminates barriers to youth sports for kids and parents by bringing enrichment programs, camps, leagues, etc. to children where they are, including in the schools where they work and play, as well as community centers and other places in the community where it makes sense to have these types of camps and engagements. Local franchises all together across the United States and Canada have served more than 775,000 kids over the years, nearly 15 years, and they're bringing in-school instruction and development in a variety of sports, including golf and tennis, as well several team sports like volleyball, ultimate frisbee, lacrosse, floor hockey, flag football, even cheerleading, as part of a curriculum built on the foundation of academics and life skills, combining the stuff that you learn in sports with the stuff you learn in class to make it a wholesome, interesting, engaging, fulfilling experience. And as a franchise owner, you'll be given the tools to succeed right away using a proven turnkey method already employed by a wide breadth of a network of fellow franchise owners that are very active and helpful to anyone in the community. If you want to learn more about TGA Premier Sports franchise opportunities, head to their website by visiting playtga.com/franchise. One more time, that's playtga.com/franchise. All right, so the second half of the show, as promised, is a return visit from Mitch Lawrence, my good friend, who was so gracious in having me down in his hometown, in his neck of the woods for the last week as part of the World Am. He could have told my ass to get the hell away after seeing me a couple of nights at the 19th hole. I had such a good time with him and with Ava. Their hospitality, got to spend a couple hours at their house one night. Got to meet their horses and Louie, who's the best dog ever. And Bob and Vicky were also great to meet as well and spend a little bit of time with. And so I wanted to have him back on to talk about his experience playing in the World Am. He finished really well, finished fifth in his flight. And also the experience of playing with the modern equipment that we talked about in a previous episode, namely from Ben Hogan Golf, but also from Newth Golf, their high heat products, so the driver and fairway woods and hybrids that he used from them as well. So without further ado, here's the conversation with Mitch Lawrence.
I want to have Mitch Lawrence back on the show with us because he participated in the World Am like I did. He participated in a different flight with a different set of sticks than he has been using for basically the last 10 years, last 12 years or so. And he originally, when we kind of had this conversation pre-World Am in a previous episode of the podcast, he was planning to split four rounds at the World Am, two with his hip raises he's been playing for a while, and two with a new set of Ben Hogan irons that we've talked about, and some new woods from Dean Newth's High Heat company, or High Heat from Newth Golf. So I wanted to have Mitch on to talk about the experience of playing in the World Am, because he's way better than I did, and also the experience of playing with this new equipment. So first, Mitch, thanks for coming back on. Second, how was your experience of the World Am playing instead of two rounds with the Hickories, playing one round with the Hickories and three with the modern stuff?
Hey, Ryan. Great to be back. As you know, always love talking to you. You and I communicated during the week at the World Am. Every night we'd meet up at the 19th hole and kind of rehash what the day was about. So you saying that I played better than you did, first of all, is striking. I'm glad I'm recording this podcast so that I can play it back later and, you know, send it to Bunch and stuff like that. Yeah, it was interesting and great. That's the only thing I can say. I had, as you said, made plans to play two rounds with the Hickories and two rounds with the modern clubs. And after the first round, I played the Hickories the first round at beautiful Pine Lakes Country Club here in Myrtle Beach, which is historic. The first club that was actually built in Myrtle Beach, and it was Robert White, who was the first president of the PGA of America, who brought it into being, came over from Scotland. It's got a lot of history at Pine Lakes, redone by Craig Schreiner. A great golf course. And even though across my flight and age being what it is, the courses were all in the 5,800 yard range, which I thought at the beginning until I looked at scorecards was going to be great. It's a little bit, if I get a 5,500 yard course with my Hickories, then I'm usually in pretty good shape. But these are all about 58. And even though that sounds really short to probably most of the people who listen to the podcast, what I found out after the first round was that the way they kind of got that yardage, there would be three or four really short holes, 100-yard par 3, 310-yard par 4, that kind of thing. And there would be maybe four or five of those holes. So they made up that distance to get to 5,800 throughout the rest of the course. So some of the par 4s were 400 yards, 380. Some of the par 3s would be 160, 170, 180. And with Hickories, that's a tough test for me, anyway. And I went through that last year, if you recall, where I was playing courses that were just too long, and it wasn't really a whole lot of fun. So after the first round, I shot 102 at Pine Lakes with a 17 handicap with the Hickories. And, you know, I thought, okay, it wasn't that great. It wasn't that terrible. It was just kind of more of a tough round. I had fun, had a great group, and you know I'll always do that. But I made the decision after the first round to just go ahead and play the modern clubs, the Hogans and the High Heat driver and fairway woods in the next three rounds and try to take a little bit of that, the work out of it. And I was really glad I did. The week turned out great. I went from, I think I started in 30, after the first round, 35th, tied for 35th in my flight, and then I progressively moved up. I shot 91 in the second round, moved up to 19th. I shot 87 in the third round, which moved me up to 5th, and then I shot 89 in the last round, which held me at 5th among 41 players. So that's where I finished. And it was an adventure. It really was an adventure. I know you are talking about what it was like, your experience of getting back to tournament golf, and I haven't played serious tournament golf since I played in the Crosby in North Carolina, which was a three-day, two-person team event for years. That was full-bore, full-on tournament pressure because you were playing for a lot of money for charity. And I hadn't done that in probably, I think the last Crosby was probably 12, 15 years ago. So for me, it was a really interesting experience, as I know it was for you, to really get back into every shot counts mode and coming back from bad holes and trying to rebound from those. And it was a truly great experience for me. And I think anybody who hasn't experienced the World Am, four straight days of that kind of golf and meeting people from all over the world, should really give it a try next year.
For you, was there a difference competitively in terms of mindset and playing with the Hickories on day one? You know, you might be behind the eight ball a little bit and playing with the modern equipment, certainly day two, but three and four maybe even as well.
Yeah, I it's golf. So I had interesting experiences every day. And I had only had the Hogan irons and the High Heat clubs for basically a week. So it's not like I've had time to really get used to it, and certainly making the shift from Hickory shafts to modern shafts. I have graphite in both of them, and they're fantastic. But what I realized was, especially the last day, it takes time to kind of get used to the different feel and the different swing you need with a Hickory club to the moderns. And that was the really interesting part to me. There's clearly more forgiveness in all the modern clubs. That's a given. When you're hitting a 100-year-old club with a small face and no forgiveness, that's kind of the way you start to play the game. Your misses can be worse. Pure shots feel incredible, but as we know, they don't happen all the time. But what I loved feeling over the course of three straight days playing the Hogans and the High Heats was every day I felt like I learned a little bit more about my swing and about kind of watching ball flights and where misses went. And there's no question that playing those clubs got me kind of back into a good groove of playing golf. You know, I have to keep reminding myself, I was a six when I was playing 4 or 5 days a week when I was single in my prior life and also younger. And now I'm 68 years old and I don't play as often, certainly. I practice every now and then, but nothing major. And I have to get used to playing a different game than I did. But what I realized with the Hogan irons especially, I thought I had dropped, I would say, between two and three clubs in length of irons from the last time I had played regular modern irons. That was what I was going in with. So if, when I was playing a lot, if I was hitting a 7-iron 150 yards, I was kind of calculating a 7-iron now to go 125, let's say. And I had to swallow that ego pill and then just say, okay, this is how I play golf now. And what I realized was when I was hitting, I mean, bad shots are bad shots. If you miss a shot and hit it off the toe and it's, you know, put some slice on it, it ain't going anywhere. I don't care what clubs you're playing. But what I realized with the Hogans and what I really love about them is the feel, the solid feel of these clubs. When I hit a pure shot, I really pretty much only lost the club. So I was hitting that 7-iron 140 yards, which for me was really good, you know. And if I'd miss it, it would go, whatever, 130, 135 yards. So I kind of regrouped a lot. And over the course of those 3 days, obviously, like you and I talk about, I hit some bad shots, made some mental mistakes. But the shots that I hit well with the Hogan irons and the high heat clubs were a revelation to me, and I'll kind of explain that part of it too. But the Hogan irons, which I tweeted something this morning that if it wasn't for my love affair with 100-year-old hickories, that these clubs would never leave my bag, because after 3 solid days of playing them, I believe what I had thought when you and I did the last podcast, which is that the quality of these clubs for the price you pay for them, I'm not saying there aren't clubs that are as solid out there, but the price you'll pay for those compared to what you can get the Hogans for and the craftsmanship and the quality of them, to me, I literally don't think there's a better deal in golf. And I felt that way more strongly after the 3 days than I ever thought I would.
I guess what were the revelations about playing modern equipment, other than the distance, the lack of distance loss, I guess, that you were expecting? You said that they're relatively forgiving, obviously more so than the hickories ever could dream to be. But in terms of maybe like ball flight, spin, maybe some of the kind of minutiae that maybe not everyone thinks about, but you're aware of, you know about, touch, those types of things, that kind of small details. How did the Hogans perform versus what you anticipated, and I guess certainly against the hickories that you can use?
Well, let's take spin out of the equation, especially with short irons, because I don't hit the kinds of shots that really produce a lot of spins. It's something I work on. I wish I did, but I don't come into the ball the way that I really should. So I don't factor in spin and being able to move a ball back as much. The one big revelation was the trajectory, which is so much higher than I hit with the hickory clubs. It was mind-boggling. I mean, when I hit some pure shots with these Hogans, I just stood there staring at it because I hadn't seen a shot that high probably in 10 years. So the way the clubs are designed, and again, these are the PTX irons, which are kind of in between the edge and the Fort Worth plaques, which are more of a really low handicap player iron. But the way they're designed, I kind of really felt I got great feel off the club face. I mean, I could tell immediately after hitting it what kind of shot it was going to be. And when you're playing hickories, you don't get that feedback immediately. I mean, when you hit a really bad shot, you know it. But, you'd kind of take a little while to see, okay, does it have any spin? Is it going to fade or draw? Is it going to go straight? But with these, the feel on the club face is so good. And the where the weight's distributed on the club face produces the kind of shot that, like I said, over the course of those 3 days, I'm going to say I hit 10 shots on the nose pure. And when they took off, I literally just stood there looking at them. I didn't want them to come down. And they got great results. And then I said, okay. And that, I think that was the biggest revelation, was just the feel and the trajectory of the irons when I hit them the way I wanted to. The mishits were obviously, as I said, not nearly as bad as with 100-year-old clubs. That's a given. But I was kind of taken aback by how well I was able to play, given my skill level and my age and everything else, with clubs that are not purely just, cavity back, hit it anywhere, and it'll go straight clubs. And that's what I was really impressed about. The high heat was, and if I can just kind of move into that, because that was that's a really different almost equation than what I was used to. I had known, you mentioned Dean Knuth, and I had known him for a number of years. I'd met him at the International Network of Golf, which was where they debuted the high heat stuff, as far as I know, and so a lot of us got to see them a number of years ago. But I was playing hickories, so I would hit them and go, oh, okay, cool, but I dismissed it. I wasn't interested. When I realized I was going to play the modern stuff, I contacted Dean and his partner and great friend and incredibly passionate human, Steve Trattner. And I talked to Steve for a long time about this idea. And, you know, he talked to Dean and we all agreed it would be great. So they sent me a driver and a 3-wood and a 5-wood. And there's so much about the technology. Dean Knuth, for those people who don't know him, worked for the USGA for years. He was called the Pope of Slope. He's the guy who actually came up with the slope and rating system for the USGA. He was involved on that level with amateur golfers for years. And as a result of that, he looked at the data from millions of rounds of golf from amateur golfers. And he came away from that experience, and he doesn't have to be doing this now with high heat, but he was so taken aback by the difference between club makers and what most amateur golfers needed in the driver and fairway woods and hybrids that he just decided to start the high heat line. And I don't know how much you know about them or the technology that's involved and why I think they're pretty different. I mean, once I got into this last couple of weeks, I did a lot of research about it. And I found that there was a lot of really big, huge technological differences between going out and buying a normal driver and why the high heat driver was incredibly impressive to me. It took me 3 days, in all honesty, to really start feeling the driver and the fairway woods. Because the biggest difference, too, is in when you're hitting a 100-year-old hickory, what's considered a driver or a brassy, which is incredibly small and, you know, just it goes without saying, you just don't get the kind of distance that you would think about. But then going from that to a pretty big head and all the differences of a modern club, it took me, on the morning of the third day, I mean, I hit some really good shots with them the first 2 days, but at the driving range, I told you this, the last day, I was on the driving range and I couldn't quite get the feel. My tendency to miss with these is kind of, as a lot of amateur golfers, is kind of this big high right, you know. It wasn't really a slice, but it was a big high fade. And right before I went to tee off on the final day, I just threw everything out and I tried something, which I won't go into before, that had worked when I was having trouble. And I started really hitting some good drives on the driving range. And I went out and played the last round and I hit 12 of 14 fairways by just concentrating on this one move I was making. And the shots that I tend to miss with these, and this is what makes high heat really different, is the misses weren't as big at all. They would still go high right, but they weren't going wild high right, like two fairways over high right, which is what I do when I tend to miss. And I don't know how deeply you want to get into the technology aspect of what makes these really good. I know you'd be interested in it. I'm not sure how deep you want to go, but suffice to say that the technology that Dean came up with, and he then took advantage of a 2016 USGA ruling that allowed for more of what we would call the trampoline effect across the entire face of the club, meaning the toe and the heel. They changed that rule and allowed more of it on those spots. And the high heat clubs actually have more of that effect on the toe and the heel than they do in the center.
Right.
Which is pretty amazing. And that's, I think, why, you know, most of us amateur golfers, the times we hit the center of the club face is not that often. So those misses on the heel and the toe, for me, and that's what I'm talking about, were just not as big. And I just hit some really, really beautiful and consistent drives with it, which I hadn't done. I mean, I was trying to remember the last time I played modern clubs, and I don't think I ever had a club that I was able to do that with. Obviously, you still have to swing the club. You still have to make contact and hit a good shot. But I think what Dean's done with these clubs is pretty amazing.
So all told, you've got all basically new equipment end to end. And you've played it for 3 rounds in this tournament. And you said earlier, you know, if you could, if you weren't enamored with hickory clubs, you would just keep these clubs in your bag forever.
Right.
So what emotion did and we talked about this in the prior podcast, having an emotional connection to your equipment. What emotion, ultimately, did the modern equipment inspire in you compared to what the Hickories inspire in you?
Well, I think what I realized was that the Hickories are a whole, that's a different book. You know, if you were writing two emotional stories, the Hickories are a complete story by themselves. And nothing will ever change that or touch it for me because there is nothing like that. Every club is a search, and every club maker is a search and a connection. And I feel those deeply with my Hickories for every club I have. So nothing will ever change that. I don't think there can ever be that kind of connection to modern clubs. I mean, you can say, yeah, I love my putter. I made a lot of putts today. But it's kind of a different story. What I loved about the ones that I have, certainly the Hogans, we talked about the game part of it, but the connection to the Hogan name and the tradition of the company for me, being the kind of person I am, is an emotional one already after three rounds. I know that sounds weird, but it was really true. I kept looking down at the name. The name is printed on these great grips they have. Does it mean I'm, you know, becoming a better golfer because I connect with Ben Hogan's name? No. But for me, I loved that aspect of it, you know, and I really felt like after 3 days straight of playing them that these are my clubs now. I'm not going to go searching, you know, anymore. And that's one thing I used to do with when I was playing modern clubs. I was always searching for something different and better. And I'm not going to do that now. I really love these, and I love that connection. The high heat, I think the connection is, yeah, the shots were great, and the experience of playing, and I'm really looking forward to just going out and playing, you know, with them more. But I think my connection, again, is to Dean and to Steve, because they are both as passionate about what they have done for amateur golfers as anybody I've met. And I think that resonates with me, is it's not just some big business company. And obviously there's nothing wrong in my mind. I'm not judging any of the big companies or business or anything like that. And I know they work to help amateur golfers too. I'm not saying that. But I think when I get hold of a small company that's very focused on one thing that can help all of us play better, and they put in the kind of research and time and, passion to get their name out, you know, a lot of people haven't heard about high heat, then I think it's a great thing. And I think that's the emotional part of it for me is, okay, I'm here. I'm with these guys. I'm part of that family. I'm part of the team. They don't pay me to do this. There's no, you know, kind of connection that way. But I am sitting here in my office looking at that bag. I've got Hickories lined up against my bookshelf, and I've got a bag with Hogan's and high heats in them. And I'm good. I'm done. I don't have to go around searching anymore. And I'm really looking forward to getting back. I'm never going to stop playing Hickories. You know that. Trust me.
Yeah.
But I can't wait to kind of get back out and you know, play with these clubs again and start feeling the shot.
To that same end, what you just talked about with working with Dean and the folks at Hogan Golf, do you feel similarly about the World AM and having 3,200-ish golfers come to your backyard every year and kind of take in what you talk about every time with Darren on the podcast, the Seaside Golf Capital of the World? What does it mean to you? And Ava does pool demonstrations every night, plays billiards, raises money for charity at the world's largest 19th hole. What does all of that mean to you personally, having been involved with it for so long?
Well, last year was the first year I actually played in the event after working
it
for so many years. So this is my second trip around. And I want to give a shout-out to Scott Tomasello and to Jeff Monday and Bill Golden and Jenna Hoddle, all the people at Myrtle Beach Golf Holiday and Golf Holiday events for the job they did, because I'm interested to hear your reaction to it, because I've seen the event kind of go, I won't say down, but there were years when it kind of, you could feel it losing interest. And I think this year they did an unbelievable job of promoting it during the whole course of the year, kind of creative, innovative promotions and social media stuff. And And at the event, I thought they did some great things, like having interviews in front of a backdrop, like a real PGA Tour press conference, where they brought players in and let them talk about the experience. And I kind of really did get a different hit, and it hit me again, as it has often, that when I'm kidding around with Darren and I say Myrtle Beach, the seaside golf capital of the world, there's no question it's seaside. He would always give me some grief about the golf capital of the world. And the realization that I have every year is that there is literally no place else on the planet, I don't care where you are, that you could have this event.
Yeah.
There's no place where you have access to 60 golf courses and bring in 3,000 or 4,000 golfers from around the world and pull it off for 4 days. And I think that was the overwhelming feeling, kind of pride in the community. And the golf pros that run these courses and the work that goes into making sure everybody has the best chance they can to have a good time. I feel like it's a very special event. And again, you know, you saw all those people on Thursday night at the 19th hole. And that was complete energy. That was just total golf energy of people who are sick in love with the game. And I'm glad we can have it here.
I'm not entirely settled on what my feelings are about the whole thing, but I do agree with you that there's no place on Earth that, and I don't think I would want there to be any other place on Earth that could pull off the World Am. Because
right.
Myrtle Beach for... It is unique. I mean, every place is unique. I get that. But Myrtle Beach seems to blend kitsch and redneck with upper class and Oceanside cool. It's just an amalgamation of a variety of things. And it has this, it spits out in the end this character that is all its own. It might be changing. I mean, there's more of a permanent population now than there ever has been. That's probably going to change the city and the surrounding area in ways we still don't even have a concept of yet. But I feel like the town itself is still really invested in not only hospitality, of course, because it's a seaside destination, but the golf industry, and that it embraces having 60 golf courses, and that the local vendors around town who participate in the food and beverage aspect of it, certainly the food each night, that they take a lot of pride in having these people come in and play golf and try their food and go into restaurants and places of business and experience, again, a wholly unique destination. And, I mean, I've played on a different end of the spectrum in terms of expectations, scoring-wise and stuff like that. But I really enjoy the people that I play with, and I think that's the key part to all of this, is the tournament's well-run, it's pretty well-organized, there's a central hub to get together every night, but if I didn't enjoy the people I played with over the 4 days, you know, the 12 people I got to meet, and then the others I got to talk with after the fact, then this would have been just an exercise in playing golf on vacation. You know, I played two rounds of golf while I was on vacation the week prior with my family. That it would have been just like doing that, except with complete strangers. So the fact that the people who got down there, whatever flight you were in, really loved golf. They wanted to have a good time for the most part. I mean, I'm sure there are some people who wanted to win more than have a good time, but they wanted to have a good time, celebrate golf, and have a great occasion to spend 4 days playing again in a place that you could not do this otherwise. I think that all together left me with a really happy memory of this experience, and one that hopefully I can do again, even though, you know, my kids are basically getting into the age now where this, like, last week of August is all of a sudden going to become back to school time. But I agree with you. I walk away with the same sentiment. You should try it. Try it once. Try it twice. You know, John and Cheryl Dunigan, who came through the podcast and spent a few days with them in the evening, they are trying to figure out whether this is something they'll do every year or other year, or how they can, you know, kind of make it part of their lives. And I think that at the start of the week, they were kind of skeptical. And by the end of the week, I think that they were really invested in it because they made so many connections with different people that you'll see them next year. And that's part of this tradition too, is being able to count on seeing not all the same people every year, but many of the same people from year to year.
Yeah, and I don't want it to seem, I'm not naive enough to say, you know, everybody you're going to play with is great. I had one group in particular last year on the final day that I wouldn't want to play with ever again. There were three guys who were, it was the final day. They were all kind of in the hunt, sort of. And nobody said a word. They were incredibly serious. It was not a fun round of golf for me. So I'm not saying that it's like being a single anywhere, and you can get great people or you can have people that you don't really connect with. But I think all in all, as golfers, we're kind of used to that if you ever play golf as a single. Or even with one other person and you get paired up with a twosome and it's not the greatest. So that potential is there, but you know, the flip side of that coin is I got to see people that, you know, have been coming for years, and I look forward to seeing them at the World Am at night once a year. They're like great old friends that you see, and you're glad they're still around and still playing and, you know, that kind of thing. So it has both sides to that coin. I think it's the opportunity to find the good connections, which I choose to, that's how I look at it. And then run with them. And then 4 days goes by, and then it's over. And then, like you said, it's back to school time, or it's work time, or whatever. It's definitely a unique experience, and I was glad the whole thing shaped up the way I did, and that I got a chance to play with the clubs I did. And, you know, it was a great week. It really was a great week, and I got to see you every day, which I never get to do.
It was fun to be able to text you or then immediately call you after, even though the results weren't always the best, but to talk about it and talk about having been in the same location, not even the same course, the same location, playing golf and then getting to recap. It was like, we've never really done that, you know, play golf
right.
In the same destination 4 days in a row, so we'll still work on that. But this was
yeah.
The closest we've gotten so far, and it was really fun to have that conversation each night, and I will not soon forget the enchilada soup at the Sheraton restaurant, which is unbelievably good.
It was good.
Very
it was great.
Good. Like world class good from a hotel. Did not expect that.
And we had our own private dining room, really. So
we did, because people bailed out on that restaurant the second the liquor booth opened. So
yeah.
we knew we had to open a restaurant, which was pretty cool too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been really fun to be in your part of the world the last 2 weeks for completely different reasons. It went by way too quickly, and we'll have to do it again. But I'm glad that you can come on and talk about this, relive it a little bit, and then hopefully, like we said, do this again, whether it's in the World Am or just for the heck of it somewhere else. But do it again and have another conversation like this. So thanks for coming
on. You bet, pal.
Thanks to Mitch again for being on the show. It is always a blast to have him on. We might have to make this a little bit more of a regular thing just to talk about golf and life and stuff, because that's kind of what this podcast has evolved into over the years, about golf and life and stuff. And no one gets golf, life, and stuff better than Mitch Lawrence, really. He's one of my favorite people to talk to about anything because he has this incredible perspective, one that I strive to have, don't always have, but strive to have. And I think that's probably why we get along pretty well. I'm going to head up to Ronimink Golf Club in Philadelphia tomorrow for the second round of the BMW Championship, so I will be up there. I will give a little bit of a report on that experience next time on the podcast. We'll talk about in the off week heading into the Tour Championship. We know Bryson DeChambeau will be number one in FedEx Cup points, so we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the reset. We will know the final member, the 24th person out of 24 to make the Ryder Cup team, if it is not Tony Finau. I will be volcanic on this podcast because he should be on that team, and we can talk a little bit about that as well. Please send me an email if you prefer to communicate that way, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. You can hit me up on Twitter @RyanBalanji. You can follow Golf News Net on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, whatever service you want at Golf News Net. With some help and input, we're looking at doing a trip to a destination next year instead of doing kind of part of a trip. Being part of a bigger trip that is the Myrtle Beach World Am. That's in part because of scheduling. I won't be able to do the World Am next year with my kids in school. So we're going to look at something probably either a little bit earlier in the summer or a little bit in early fall. So we're working on that. We're going to get it down to a couple of different destinations. We've got some front runners in contention. I think you're going to love them, especially if you live in the Midwest. They'll be fairly close to you, but either way, we will make sure, as kind of word gets out about that, we'll make that announcement. Hopefully, those of you can get a heads up about that, and if you're interested in attending, we can make that happen. I would love to meet all of you. If you're listening to this show and have a similar frame of reference to me and you've enjoyed this show for however many years, it's always good to put names with faces. I can't tell you again how much I enjoyed meeting John and Cheryl and just being able to talk to them each night and about anything. I mean, not just about GNN. We hardly talked about that, but golf, life, all kinds of stuff. That's kind of why I do this. So that's going to do it for us on this episode of the show. Hopefully we'll catch you next time after the BMW Championship from Philadelphia. And until then, I'm Ryan Balaji saying so long. We'll see you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.